acknowledged. If you have some concrete alibi.
She shook her head. No alibi. Only that I know my husband.
The elevator door had closed, and Jill and I stood there waiting again. As in hospitals, it would take minutes for it to go down and come back up. Chessie Jenks didn't make a move to walk away.
My husband's not a simple man. He can be very tough. I know he's made enemies. I know how he came at you. From the outside, it must be very hard to believe this, but there are times when he's also capable of tenderness, incredible generosity, and love.
I don't mean to sound unsympathetic, Miss Jenks, Jill stepped in, but under the circumstances, you really shouldn't be talking with us.
I have nothing to hide, she came back.
Then she looked downcast.
I already know what you know.
I was dumbfounded. I already know what you know?
I spoke with Joanna, Chessie Jenks continued. She told me you'd been by. I know what she told you about him. She's bitter. She's got every right to be. But she doesn't know Nick like I do.
You should review the evidence, Miss Jenks, I told her. She shook her head.
Guns, maybe, Inspector, if that's all there was. But a knife? That first murder? Slicing that poor couple to bits? Nick can't even fillet a fish.
My first thought was that she was young and deluded.
How had Jenks described it?
Impressionable. But something struck me as curious.
You said that you and Joanna talk? We have. A lot more in the past year. I've even had her over. When Nick was away, of course. I know she was bitter after the divorce. I know he hurt her. But it's sort of our own support group.
Your husband knew about this? I asked.
She forced a smile. He didn't even mind. He still likes Joanna. And, Inspector, she's still in love with him.
The elevator returned, and we said goodbye. As the door closed, I looked at Jill. Her eyes were wide, and her tongue was puffing out her cheek. "Whole fucking family gives me the creeps," she said with a shudder. Chapter 99 I knew it the minute Medved walked in the office. I saw it in his face. He didn't have to say a word.
I'm afraid I can't be very positive, Lindsay, he said, meeting my eyes. Your red count continues to decline. The dizzy spells, the fatigue, blood in your chest. The disease is progressing.
Progressing?
Medved nodded soberly.
Stage 3.
The words thundered in my head, bringing with them the fear of the increased treatments I dreaded.
What's the next step? I asked weakly. We can give it one more month, Medved said. Your count's 2400. If it continues to decline, your strength will start to go. You'll have to be hospitalized.
I could hardly comprehend what he was saying. It was all crashing in my brain so fast. A month? That's too close. Too fast. Things were just starting to work out now that Jenks had been arrested. Everything else, everything I wanted to hold on to, was resolving too.
A month? 4 lousy weeks!
When I got back to the office, a few of the guys were standing around grinning at me. There was a beautiful bouquet of flowers on my desk. Wildflowers. I smelled them, taking in the sweet, natural scent. I read the card. There's a hill of these where I have a cabin up at Heavenly. Tomorrow's Friday. Take the day off. Let's go there. It was signed, Chris. It sounded like what I needed. The mountains. Chris. I would have to tell him. Now that the truth would come clear soon. My phone rang. It was Chris.
So?
No doubt someone in the office playing Cupid had alerted him that I was back. Haven't opened your card yet, I bit my lip. Too many others to sort through. I heard a disappointed sigh, let it linger just a moment. But on the chance you were asking me away, the answer is I'd love to. It sounds great. Let's be on the road by 8.
Late riser, he said. I was hoping we'd beat the morning rush.
I was talking tonight.
I had a month. I was thinking, mountain air, running streams, and wildflowers is a good way to begin.
Chapter 100.
We spent the next 2 days as if we were in a beautiful dream. Chris's cabin was funky and charming, a redwood A-frame ski chalet on Mason Ridge overlooking Heavenly. We hiked in the woods with Sweet Martha, took the tram to the top of the mountain, and walked all the way down. We grilled swordfish on the deck. In between, we made love in the comfort of his large four-poster bed, on the sheepskin rug in front of the wood-burning stove, in the chilly thrill of the outdoor shower. We laughed and played and touched each other like teenagers, discovering love again. But I was no starry-eyed adolescent. I knew exactly what was taking place. I felt the steady, undeniable current rising inside me like a river spilling over its banks. I felt helpless. Saturday, Chris promised me a day I would never forget. We drove down to Lake Tahoe to a quaint marina on the California side. He had rented a platform boat, an old puttering wooden barge. We bought sandwiches and a bottle of Chardonnay and went out to the middle of the lake. The water calm and turquoise, the sky cloudless and bright. All around, the rocky tips of snow-capped mountains ringed the lake like a crown. We moored, and for a while it was our own private world. Chris and I stripped down to our suits. I figured we'd kick back, enjoy the wine and the sun, look at the view. But Chris had sort of an expectant dare-you look in his eye. He ran his hands through the frigid water. "No way," I said, shaking my head. "It's got to be 50 degrees." "Yeah, but it's a dry cold," he teased. "Right," I chortled. "You go then. Catch me a coho if you see one swim by." He came toward me with playful menace in his eyes. "You can catch one yourself." "Not a chance," I shook my head in defiance. But I was laughing, too. As he stepped forward, I backed to the rear of the craft until I ran out of room. He put his arms around me. I felt the tingle of his skin on mine. "It's sort of an initiation," he said. "An initiation for what?" "Exclusive club. Anyone who wants to be in it has to jump in." "Then leave me out," I laughed, squirming in his strong arms. With only weak resistance, he yanked me up on the cushioned seat in the stern of the boat. "Shit, Chris," I cried as he took hold of my hand. "Geronimo works better," he said, pulling at me. I screamed, "You bastard!" And we toppled in. The water was freezing, a total invigorating rush. We hit the surface together, and I screamed in his face, "God damn you!" Then he kissed me in the water, and all at once I felt no chill. I held on to him, at first for warmth, but also because I never wanted to let him go. I felt a trust for him that was so complete, it was almost scary. 50 degrees, but I was burning up. "Check this out," I dared him, kicking free of his grasp. There was an orange boat marker bobbing 50 yards away. "Race you to that buoy!" Then I cut out, surprising him with my speed. Chris tried to keep up with steady, muscular strokes, but I blew him away. Near the buoy, I slowed, waited for him to catch up. Chris looked totally confounded. "Where'd you learn to swim?" "South San Francisco YMCA, 14-15-16-year-old division champ," I laughed. "No one could keep up. Looks like I still have it." Moments later, we had guided the boat to a private, shady cove near the shore. Chris cut the engine and put up a canvas shade around the cabin that was supposed to protect us from the sun. With bated breath, we crept inside, blocked off from anyone's view. I let him slowly unfasten my bathing suit, and he licked beads of water off my arms and breasts. Then I kneeled down and unbuttoned his shorts. We didn't have to speak. Our bodies were saying everything. I lay back, pulling Chris onto me. I had never felt so connected to another person, or to a place. I arched against him silently, the lake lapping gently at our sides. I thought, if I speak, it will change everything. Afterward, I just lay there, tremors of warmth radiating through my body. I never wanted this to end, but I knew that it had to end. Reality always gets in the way, doesn't it? Chapter 101. Sometime that evening, I found myself starting to cry. I had made spaghetti carbonara, and we ate in the moonlight on the deck with a bottle of Pinot Noir. Chris put a cello concerto by Dvorak on the stereo, but eventually we switched to the Dixie Chicks. As we ate, Chris asked about where and how I had grown up. I told him about my mom and how my dad had left when I was just a kid, how she had worked as a bookkeeper at the Emporium for 20 years, how I had practically raised my sister. Mom died of breast cancer when she was only 50. The irony of this certainly wasn't lost on me.
What about your father? I want to know everything about you.
I took a sip of wine, then told him how I'd only seen him twice since I was 13. At my mother's funeral, and the day I became a cop. He sat in the back, apart from everybody else. Suddenly my blood became hot with long-buried feelings. What was he doing there? I looked up, my eyes moist. Why did he spoil it?
You ever want to see him?
I didn't answer. Something was starting to take shape in my head. My mind drifted, struck by the fact that here I was, maybe the happiest I had been, but it was all built on a lie. I was blinking back the impact of what was going through my mind. Not doing real well. Chris reached over and grasped my hand. I'm sorry, Lindsay, I had no right to...
That's not it,
I whispered and squeezed his hand. I knew it was time to really trust him, time to finally give myself over to Chris. But I was scared, my cheeks trembling, my eyes holding back tears.
I have something to tell you, I said. This is a little heavy, Chris.
I looked at him with all the earnestness and trust my worried eyes could manage.
Remember when I almost fainted in the room with Jenks?
Chris nodded. Now he looked a little worried. His forehead was furrowed with deep lines.
Everyone thought I was just freaked out, but it wasn't that. I'm sick, Chris. I may have to go into the hospital soon.
I saw the light in his eyes suddenly dim. He started to speak, but I put my finger to his lips.
Just listen to me for a minute, okay?
Okay. I'm sorry. I poured out everything about Neglis. I was not responding to treatments. Hope was fading. What Medved had warned only days before, I was in stage 3, serious. A bone marrow transplant might be next. I didn't cry. I told him straight out, like a cop. I wanted to give him hope, to show him I was fighting, to show him I was the strong person I thought he loved. When I was done, I clasped his hands and took a monumental breath.
The truth is, I could die soon, Chris.
Our hands were tightly entwined, our eyes locked. We couldn't have been more in touch. Then he placed his hand gently on my cheek and rubbed it. He didn't say a word, just took me and held me in the power and softness of his hands and drew me to him. And that's what made me cry. He was a good person. I might lose him. And I cried for all the things we might never do. I cried and cried, and with each sob he pressed me harder. He kept whispering, "It's all right, Lindsay. It's all right. It's all right."
"I should have told you,"
I said. "I understand why you didn't. How long have you known?" I told him.
"Since the day we met. I feel so ashamed."
"Don't be ashamed," he said. "How could you know you could trust me?"
"I trusted you pretty quickly. I didn't trust myself."
"Well, now you do," Chris whispered.
Chapter 102. I think we rocked all night. We laughed some, cried some. I don't even remember how I woke up in bed. The following day, I barely left his touch. With all that was threatening, all that seemed uncertain, I felt so safe and sure in his arms. I never wanted to leave. But something else happened during that weekend. Apart from Neglis, apart from Chris and me, something gripping, invading my sense of comfort and security. It was something Jacoby had said that planted the thought. One of those thrown-out remarks you didn't pay much attention to, but somehow got filed away in your mind. Then it comes back at the oddest time, with more force and logic than before. It was Sunday night. The weekend was over. Chris had driven me home. Hard as it was to leave him, I needed to be alone for a while to take inventory of the weekend, to figure out what I would do next. I unpacked, made some tea, curled up on my couch with her sweetness. My mind wandered to the murder case. Nicholas Jenks was behind me now, only the countless reports to fill out, even though he was still ranting about being set up. It was just more insanity, more lies. It was then that Jacoby's words snaked into my brain. "Good collar," he'd said early Tuesday morning. He had that annoying, persistent look in his eyes. "Just remember," he'd called after me, "it was the champagne match that got you on your way. Why do you think Jenks left that champagne?" I was barely paying attention. Jenks was locked away. The case was a slam dunk. I was thinking about the night before and Chris. I stopped on the stairs and turned to him. "I don't know, Warren. We've been over this. Heat of the moment, maybe." "You're right," he nodded. "That must be why he didn't ball up the jacket and take it with him, too."
I looked at him like, why are we going through this now? Jenks needed a clean tux jacket to get out of the hotel undetected.
The DNA match on the hair made it all academic, anyway.
Then he said it.
"You ever read the whole book?" he asked.
"Which book?"
"Jenks's book, Always a Bridesmaid."
"The parts that matter," I replied. "Why?"
He said, "I don't know, it just sort of stuck with me. Like I said, my wife happens to be a fan. There were some copies of the manuscript around, so I took one home. It was interesting how it all came out in the end."
I looked at him, trying to figure out where all this was heading.
"It was a setup," Jacoby said. "This Philip Campbell guy, he gets off. He pins the whole thing on someone else."
Days later, Warren's words came creeping back into my mind. A setup. He pins the whole thing on someone else. It was ridiculous, I told myself, that I was even dignifying this scenario, running through it in my mind. Everything was solid, airtight. "Setup," I found myself thinking again. "I must be an idiot," I said aloud. "Jenks is clinging to any story he can to wiggle his way out of this." I got up, brought my tea into the bathroom, began to wash my face. In the morning, I would tell Cheery about my disease. I had some time coming. I would face this thing head on. Now that the case was complete, it was the right time. Now that the case was complete! I went into the bedroom, ripped the tags off a little bit of heaven, a t-shirt Chris had bought me. I got into bed, and Martha came around for her hug. Memories of the weekend began to drift in my head. I closed my eyes. I could hardly wait to share it with the girls. Then a thought from out of the blue hit me. I shot up as if I'd had a nightmare. I stiffened. "Oh, no. Oh, Jesus, no," I whispered. When Jenks had lunged at me at his house, he had swung with his left hand. When he'd offered me a drink, he'd picked up the pitcher with his left hand. Impossible, I thought. This can't be happening. Claire was certain David Brandt's killer had been right-handed.
Chapter 103.
Jill, Claire, and Cindy looked at me as if I were insane. The words had barely tumbled out of my mouth. "What if Jenks is right? What if someone is trying to set him up?"
"That's a crock," snapped Jill. "Jenks is desperate and only moderately clever. We've got him."
"I can't believe you're saying this," exclaimed Cindy. "You're the one who found him. You're the one who made the case." "I know. I know it seems crazy. Hopefully it is crazy. Just hear me out." I took them through Jacoby's comment about the novel, then my lightning bolt about Jenks's left-handedness.
"Proves nothing," Jill said. "I can't get past the science, Lindsay," Claire said with a shake of her head. "We've got his goddamn DNA at the scene."
"Look," I protested, "I want the guy as much as anybody. But now that we have all this evidence..." "Well, it's just so neat. The jacket, the champagne. Jenks has set up complicated murders in his books. Why would he leave clues behind?"
"Because he's a sick bastard, Lindsay. Because he's an arrogant prick who's connected to all three crimes."
Jill nodded. "He's a writer. He's an amateur at actually doing anything. He just fucked up."
You saw his reactions, Jill. They were deeper than simply desperation. I've seen killers on death row still in denial. This was more unsettling, like disbelief.
Jill stood up, her icy blue eyes spearing down at me.
Why, Lindsay? Why the sudden about-face?
For the first time, I felt alone and separated from the people I had most learned to trust.
No one could possibly hate this man more than I do, I declared. I hunted him. I saw what he did to those women.
I turned to Claire.
You said the killer was right-handed.
Probably right-handed, Claire came back.
What if he simply held the knife in his other hand, proposed Cindy.
Cindy, if you were going to kill someone, I said, someone larger and stronger, would you go at him with your opposite hand?
Maybe not, interjected Jill, but you're throwing all this up in the face of facts, evidence and reason, Lindsay, all the things we work to assemble.
What you're giving me back is a set of hypotheticals.
Jenks holds his pitcher with his left hand. Philip Campbell sets someone up at the end of his book. Lindsay, we have the guy pinned to 3 double murders. I need you firm on this.
Her jaw was quivering.
I need you to testify.
I didn't know how to defend myself.
I had wanted to nail Jenks as eagerly as any one of us. More!
But now, after being so sure, I couldn't put it away. The sudden doubt. Did we have the right man?
We still haven't uncovered a weapon, I said to Jill. We don't need a weapon, Lindsay. We have his hair inside one of the victims.
Suddenly, we were aware that people from other tables were looking at us. Jill huffed and sat back down. Claire put her arms around my shoulders. I puffed a deep breath into my cheeks, slumped back against the cushion of the booth. Finally, Cindy said,
"We've been behind you all the way. We're not going to abandon you now."
Jill shook her head.
"You want me to let him go, guys, while we reopen the case? If we don't try him, Cleveland will."
"I don't want you to let him go," I said. "I only want to be 100% sure."
"I am sure,"
Jill replied, her eyes ablaze. I sought out Claire, and even she had a skeptical expression fixed firmly in my direction.
"There's an awful lot of physical evidence that makes it pretty clear."
"If this gets out," Jill warned, "you can toss my career out with the cat litter.
Bennett wants this guy's blood on the courthouse wall."
"Look at it this way," Cindy said, chuckling. "If Lindsay's right, and you send Jenks up, they'll be studying this case as a how not to for 20 years to come."
Numbly, we looked around the table. It was as if we were staring at the pieces of some shattered, irreplaceable vase.
"Okay, so, if it's not him," Claire said with a sigh, "then how do we go about proving who it is?"
It was as if we were all the way back to the beginning, all the way back at the first crime. I felt awful.
"What was the thing that nailed our suspicion on Jenks?" I asked.
"The hair," said Claire.
"Not quite. We had to get to him before we knew who it belonged to."
"Merrill Shortley," Jill said.
"Jenks and Merrill? You think?"
I shook my head. "We still needed one more thing before we could take him in."
Cindy said, "Always a bridesmaid. His first wife."
I nodded slowly as I left Susie's. Chapter 104. Over the next few days, I went back over everything we had on Joanna Wade. First, I reread the domestic complaint she'd filed against Jenks. I looked at pictures of Joanna taken at the station. Bruised, puffy-faced. I read through the officer's account of what they found at the scene. Exchanges laced with invectives. Jenks swinging wildly, clearly enraged. He had to be subdued, resisted arrest. The report was signed by 2 officers from Northern, Samuel Delgado and Anthony Faziola. The following day I went back out to visit Greg Marks, Jenks's former agent. He was even more surprised at my visit when I told him I was there on a different aspect of Jenks's past.
"Joanna?" he replied with an amused smile. "Bad judge of men, Inspector, but a worse judge of timing."
He explained that their divorce had been finalized only 6 months before Crossed Wire hit the stands. He said the book sold nearly 1 million copies in hardcover alone. To have put up with Nicholas through all the lean years, then come away with barely more than cab fare, he shook his head. The settlement was a pittance compared to what it would have been if they had filed a year later. What he told me painted a different picture of the woman I had met in the gym. She seemed to have put it all behind her. She felt used, dropped, like worn baggage. Joanna had put him through school, supported him when he first started writing. When Nick bagged law school, she even went back to her job. And afterward, I asked, did she continue to hate him? I believe she continued to try and sue him. After they split up, she tried to sue him for a lien against future earnings. Non-performance, breach of contract, anything she could find. I felt sorry for Joanna Wade, but could it drive her to that kind of revenge? Could it cause her to kill 6 people? The following day, I obtained a copy of the divorce proceedings from county records. Through the usual boilerplate, I got the sense it was an especially bitter case. She was seeking $3 million judgment against future earnings. She ended up with $5,000 a month, escalating to $10,000 if Jenks's earnings substantially increased. I couldn't believe the bizarre transformation that was starting to take over my mind. It had been Joanna who had first mentioned the book, who felt cheated, spurned, and carried a resentment far deeper than what she had revealed. Joanna, the Taibo instructor who was strong enough to take down a man twice her size, who even had access to the Jenks' home. It seemed crazy to be thinking this way. More than preposterous, it was impossible. The murders were committed by a male, by Nicholas Jenks. Chapter 105. The next day, as we shared a hot dog and a pretzel in front of City Hall, I told Chris what I'd found. He looked at me in much the same way the girls had a few days before. Shock, confusion, disbelief. But he didn't get negative. She could have set the whole thing up, I said. She knew about the book. She lobbed it out there for us to find. She knew Jenks's taste. Champagne, clothes, his involvement with Sparrow Ridge. She even had access to the house. I might buy it, he said, but these murders were committed by a man. Jenks, Lindsay, we even have him on film. Or someone made up to look like Jenks. Every sighting of him was inconclusive. Lindsay, the DNA was a match. I spoke to the officers who went to the house when he beat Joanna, I pressed on. They said, as enraged as Jenks was, she was dishing it right back to him, just as strong. They had to restrain her as they took him away in the car. She dropped the charges, Lindsay. She got tired of being abused. She may not have gotten what she deserved, but she filed and started a new life. That's just it, Chris. She didn't file. It was Jenks who left her. She sacrificed everything for Jenks. Marx described her as a model of codependency. I could see Chris wanted to believe, but he was unconvinced. I had a man in jail with almost incontrovertible evidence against him, and here I was unraveling everything. What was the matter with me? Then, out of the blue, something came back to me, something I'd filed away long ago. Laurie Birnbaum, the witness from the Brandt wedding. How she had described the man she saw. Something strange. The beard made him seem older, but the rest of him was young. Joanna Wade, medium height, right-handed, the Taibo instructor, was strong enough to handle a man twice her size. And Jenks's 9mm. He said he hadn't seen it in years. At the house in Montana, the records showed he had bought the gun 10 years ago, when he was married to Joanna. You should see her, I said with rising conviction. She's tough enough to handle any of us. She's the one link who knew about everything. Wine, clothes, always a bridesmaid. She had the means to pull it all together. The photos, the sightings were inconclusive. What if it was her, Chris? I was holding his hand, my mind racing with the possibilities, when I felt a sudden awful tightness in my chest. I thought it was the shock of what I had just proposed, but it hit me with the speed of an oncoming train. Vertigo, nausea. It swept from my stomach to my head.
Lindsay, Chris said. I felt his hand bracing my shoulder.
I feel kind of weird, I muttered.
The sweats, a rush, then terrible lightheadedness, as if armies were marching and clashing in my chest. Lindsay, he said again, this time with real concern. I leaned into him. This was the weirdest, scariest sensation. I felt both momentarily robbed of strength and then back in control. Lucid, and then very woozy again. I saw Chris, and then I didn't. I saw who killed the brides and grooms, and then it faded away. I felt myself falling toward the sidewalk. Chapter 106. I found myself coming to on a wooden park bench in Chris's arms. He held me tightly while my strength returned. Orenthaler had warned me. It was stage 3, crunch time in my body. I didn't know which held more apprehension for me, going on chemo and gearing up for a bone marrow transplant, or feeling my strength eaten away from the inside. You can't let it win. I'm okay, I told him, my voice getting stronger. I was told to expect this. You're trying to do too much, Lindsay. Now you're talking about reopening a whole new investigation. I took a deep breath and nodded. I just need to be strong enough to see this through. We sat there for a while. I could feel the color in my face reviving, the strength in my limbs returning. Chris held me, cuddled me tenderly. We must have looked like two lovers trying to find privacy in a very public place. Finally, he said, What you were describing, Lindsay, about Joanna, you really think it's true? It could still add up to nothing. She hadn't lied about her separation from Jenks, or about her current relationship with both him and Jesse. Had she concealed a bitter hatred? She had the knowledge, the means. I think the killer is still out there, I said. Chapter 107. I decided to take a huge risk. If I blew it, it could knock the lid right off my case. I decided to run what I suspected by Jenks. I met him in the same visiting room. He was accompanied by his lawyer, Leff. He didn't want to meet, convinced there was no longer a point in talking with the police, and I didn't want to convey my true intent and end up feeding their defense arguments if I was wrong. Jenks seemed sullen, almost depressed. His cool and meticulous appearance had deteriorated into an edgy, unshaven mess. "What do you want now?" he sneered, barely meeting my eyes. "I want to know if you were able to come up with anyone who would like to see you in here," I said. "Pounding the lid on my coffin," he said with a mirthless smile. "Let's just say, in the interest of doing my duty, I'm giving you one final chance to pry it back open." Jenks snorted skeptically. "Sherman tells me I'm about to be charged in Napa with 2 more murders. Isn't that great? If this is an offer of assistance, I think I'll take my chances on proving it myself." "I didn't come here to trap you, Mr. Jenks. I came to hear you out." Leff leaned over and whispered in his ear. He seemed to be encouraging Jenks to talk. The prisoner looked up with a disgusted glare. "Someone's running around, intent to look like me, familiar with my first novel. This person also wants to see me suffer. Is it so hard to figure out?"
"I'm willing to hear any names," I told him.
"Greg Marks."
"Your former agent?"
"He feels like I owe him my fucking career. I've cost him millions. Since I left, he hasn't gotten a worthwhile client. And he's violent. Marks belongs to a shooting club."
"How would he have gotten his hands on your clothing, or been able to get a sample of your hair?"
"You find that out. You're the police."
"Did he know you'd be in Cleveland that night? Did he know about you and Kathy Kogut?"
"Nick is merely proposing," Leff cut in, "that other possibilities do exist for who could be behind these crimes." I shifted in my seat. "Who else knew about the book?" Jenks twitched.
"It wasn't something I paraded around. A couple of old friends. My first wife, Joanna."
"Any of them have any reason to want to set you up?"
Jenks sighed uncomfortably.
My divorce, as you may know, was not exactly what they call mutually agreeable. No doubt there was a time Joanna would have been delighted to find me on a deserted road while she was cruising along at 60. But now that she's back on her feet with a new life, now that she's even gotten to know Chessie, I don't think so. No, it isn't Joanna. Trust me on that.
I ignored the remark and looked firmly into his eyes. You told me your ex-wife's been to your house.
Maybe once or twice.
So she'd have access to certain things. Maybe the wine, maybe what was in your closet?
Jenks seemed to contemplate the possibility for a moment, then his mouth crinkled into a contemptuous smile.
Impossible. No, it isn't Joanna.
How can you be so sure?
He looked at me as if he were stating an understood fact.
Joanna loved me. She still does. Why do you think she hangs around, covets a relationship with my new wife? Because she misses the view? It's because she cannot replace what I gave her. How I loved her. She is empty without me. What do you think? He snorted. Joanna's been holding specimens of my hair in a jar ever since we were divorced.
He sat there stroking his beard while the resolve on his face softened into a glimmer of possibility.
Someone has it in for me. But Joanna, she was just a little clerk when I met her. She didn't know Ralph Lauren from JCPenney's. I gave her self-esteem. I devoted myself to her, and she to me. She sacrificed for me, even worked two jobs when I decided to write.
It was hard to think of Jenks as anything other than the ruthless bastard who was responsible for these horrible crimes, but I pressed on.
You said the tuxedo was an old suit. You didn't even recognize it.
And the gun, Mr. Jenks, the 9mm, you said you hadn't seen it in years, that you thought it was kept somewhere at your house in Montana. Are you so sure this might not have been planned for some time?
I could see Jenks subtly shifting his expression as he came around to the impossible conclusion.
You said that when you started writing, Joanna took a second job to help support you. Just what sort of work?
Jenks stared up toward the ceiling. Then he seemed to remember.
She worked at Saks.
Chapter 108. Slowly, unavoidably, I was starting to feel as if I were on the wrong airplane, heading to the wrong city. Against all logic, I was growing surer and surer that Nicholas Jenks might not be the killer.
Oh, brother!
I had to figure out what to do. Jenks in handcuffs was the lead picture in both Time and Newsweek. He was being arraigned in Napa for two additional murders the following day. Maybe I should just stay on the wrong plane, get out of town, never show my face in San Francisco again. I got the girls together. I took them through the mosaic that was starting to come clear. The acrimonious contest over the divorce, Joanna's sense of being discarded, her direct access to the victims through her contacts at Saks. She was an assistant store manager, I told them. Coincidence?
Get me proof, Jill said, because as of now I have proof against Nick Jenks, all the proof I need.
I could hear the worry and frustration in her voice. The whole country was watching this case, watching her every move. We had worked so hard to sell Mercer and her boss, Sinclair, on the idea that it was Jenks, and now, after all that, to propose a new theory and suspect.
Authorize a search, I told Jill. Joanna Wade's house. Something has to be there. The missing rings, a weapon, details on the victims. It's the only way we'll ever pin it down.
Authorize a search? On what basis? Suspicion of new evidence? I can't do that without blowing this case wide open again. If we show we're not even sure, how can I convince a jury?
We could check where she worked, proposed Cindy. See if she had specific access to information on the brides.
That's circumstantial. It's crap, Jill cried. One of my neighbors works at Saks. Maybe she's the murderer.
You can't go through with this, argued Cindy, if we still have doubt.
You have doubt, said Jill. What I have is everything in place for a slam-dunk conviction. To you, it's a story. You follow it where it leads. My whole career is on the line.
Cindy looked stunned. You think I'm here for just the story?
You think I sat on every lead, agonized over not being able to go to copy, just so I could wind up with the book rights later on?
Come on, girls, said Claire, her arm on Cindy's shoulder. We have to be together on this.
Slowly, Jill's intense blue eyes softened. She turned to Cindy. I'm sorry, she said. It's just that when this gets out, Lef will be able to plant huge doubts in that jury's mind.
But we can't back down now just because it's bad tactics, said Claire. There could be a murderer out there. A multiple murderer.
I said to Jill, authorize a search. Come on, Jill. I'd never seen Jill look so upset. Everything she had achieved in her career, everything she stood for, was being placed squarely on the line. She shook her head. Let's try it Cindy's way. We'll start with sex. Check Joanna out there. Thank you, Jill, I said. You're the best. She exhaled resignedly. Find out if she's had any contact with anyone who had access to those names. Connect Joanna with those names, and I'll get you what you want. But if you can't, be prepared to fry Jenks. From across the table, I took her hand. She gripped mine. We exchanged a nervous smile. Jill finally joked, Personally, I hope all you come back with is the hot item to be featured in the next Christmas catalog. Claire laughed loudly. Now that wouldn't be a total loss, would it? Chapter 109 The following day, the day Nicholas Jenks was set to be arraigned for the murders of Rebecca and Michael DeGeorge, I set out to track down a new killer. I couldn't let Jenks know we were looking that closely at Joanna. Of course, I didn't want Joanna to know we were focusing suspicion on her either. And I didn't want to face Mercer's or Roth's reactions. With all this going on, it was my Medved day, too. After that spell in the park with Chris 3 days before, I had gone for a blood test. Medved called back himself, told me he wanted me to come in. Being called in again like that scared me, like that first time with Dr. Roy. That morning, Medved kept me waiting. When he finally called me in, there was another doctor in his office, older, with white hair and bushy white eyebrows. He introduced himself as Dr. Robert Yatto. The sight of a new doctor sent a chill through me. He could only be there to talk about the bone marrow procedure.
Dr. Yatto is head of hematology at Moffitt, Medved said. I asked him to look at your latest sample.
Yatto smiled.
How are you feeling, Lindsay?
Sometimes okay, sometimes incredibly weak, I answered. My chest felt tight. Why did I have to go through this with someone new?
Tell me about the other day.
I did my best to recount the reeling spell I'd had in City Hall Park.
Any emissions of blood?
Yatto asked matter-of-factly. No, not lately.
Vomiting?
Not since last week. Dr. Yatto got up, came across the desk to me.
Do you mind?
He asked as he cradled my face in his hands. He expressionlessly pressed my cheeks with his thumb, pulled down my eyes, and peered into my pupils under my lids. I know I'm getting worse, I said. Yatto released my face, nodded toward Medved. Then, for the first time since I'd started seeing him, Medved actually smiled.
It's not getting worse, Lindsay. That's why I asked Bob to consult. Your erythrocytic count jumped back up to 2,800.
I gave a double take to make sure I had heard right, that it wasn't some kind of wishful dream I was playing out in my own mind. But the spells, the hot and cold flashes, the other day I felt like a war was going on in me.
There is a war, Dr. Yatto said. You're reproducing cells.
The other day, that wasn't Negley's talking. That was you.
That's how it feels to heal.
I was stunned. My throat was dry. Say that again?
It's working, Lindsay, Medved said. Your red blood count has increased for the second time in a row. I didn't want to tell you in case it was an error, but as Dr. Yatto said, you're building new cells.
I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. This is real? I can trust this? I asked.
This is very real, Medved said with a nod.
I stood up, my whole body shaking, tingling with disbelief. For a moment, all the joys that I had suppressed, a chance at my career, running on Marina Green, a life with Chris, came tumbling through my brain. For so long, I had been so scared to let them free. Now they seemed to burst out of me.
Medved leaned forward and warned, "You're not cured, Lindsay. We'll continue the treatments twice a week, but this is hopeful. More than hopeful, Lindsay. This is good."
I don't know what to say. My body was totally numb. I don't know what to do.
"If I were you," Dr. Yarrow said, "I'd bring to mind the one thing you might have thought you'd miss most, and go do that today."
I wandered out of the office in a haze, down the elevator, through the sterile lobby, into a flowered courtyard that overlooked Golden Gate Park. The sky was bluer than I'd ever seen it, the air off the bay sweeter and cooler and more pure. I stood there, just hearing the beautiful sounds of my own breaths. Something crept back into my life that had been away, something I never thought I would embrace again. Hope.
Chapter 110. "I have something to tell you," I said to Chris on the phone, my voice ringing with urgency. "Can you meet me for lunch?"
"Sure, you bet. Where?"
No doubt he thought I had some important news to break on the case.
"Casa Boxer," I said with a smile.
"That urgent, huh?" Chris laughed into the phone. "I must be starting to have a bad effect on you. When should I come?"
"I'm waiting now."
It took him barely 15 minutes to arrive at the door. I'd stopped on the way at Nestor's Bakery and picked up some freshly baked cinnamon buns. Then I popped a bottle of Piper Heidsieck that I'd saved in my fridge. Never in 6 years had I bugged out on a case in the middle of the afternoon, especially one of this magnitude. But I felt no guilt, none at all. I thought of the craziest way I could break the good news. I met him at the door, wrapped in a bedsheet. His big blue eyes went wide with surprise. "I'll need to see some ID," I grinned.
"Have you been drinking?" he said.
"No, but we're about to." I pulled him into the bedroom. At the sight of the champagne, he shook his head.
"What is it you want to tell me?"
"Later," I said. I poured him a glass and began to unfasten the buttons of his shirt. "But trust me, it's good."
"It's your birthday," he said, smiling.
I let the bedsheet drop. "I would never do this for just my birthday."
"My birthday, then."
"Don't ask. I'll tell you later."
"You broke the case," he exclaimed. "It was Joanna. You found something that broke the case."
I put my fingers to his lips.
"Tell me that you love me."
"I do love you," he said.
"Tell me again, like you did at Heavenly. Tell me that you won't ever leave me."
Maybe he sensed it was Negley's talking, some crazy hysteria, or that I just needed to feel close. He hugged me.
"I won't leave you, Lindsay. I'm right here."
I took his shirt off, slowly, very slowly, then his trousers. He must have felt like the delivery boy who had stumbled into a sure thing. He was as hard as a rock. I brought a glass of champagne to his lips, and we both took a sip from it.
"Okay, I'll just go with this. Shouldn't be too difficult," he said.
I drew him to the bed, and for the next hour we did the one thing I knew I would have missed most in the world. We were in the middle of things when I felt the first terrifying rumbling. At first it was so weird, as if the bed had speeded up and was rocking faster than we were. Then there was a deep grinding sound coming from all directions, as if we were in an echo chamber. Then the sound of glass breaking. My kitchen, a picture frame falling off the wall. And I knew, we knew.
"It's a goddamn quake," I said.
I had been through many of these. Anyone who lived here had. But it was startling and terrifying every time. You never knew if this was the big one. It wasn't. The room shook, a few dishes broke. Outside, I heard the bleat of horns and triggered car alarms. The whole thing lasted maybe 20 seconds. 2, 3, 4 vibrating tremors. I ran to the window. The city was still there. There was a rumble, like as if a massive humpback whale were breaching underground. Then it was still. Eerie, insecure,
as if the whole town were holding on for balance. I heard wailing sirens, the sound of voices shouting on the street.
"You think we should go?" I asked.
"Probably. We're cops."
He touched me again, and suddenly I was tingling all over, and we melted into each other's arms.
"What the heck? We're homicide, anyway."
We kissed, and once again we were locked into a single intertwined shape. I started to laugh. "The list," I was thinking. "The skybox, now an earthquake. This sucker's starting to get pretty long." My beeper went off. I cursed, rolled over, glanced at the screen. It was the office. "Code 111, I told Chris. "Emergency alert." "Shit," I muttered. "It's just an earthquake." I sat up, pulled the sheet over me, called in on the phone next to the bed. It was Roth buzzing me. Roth never buzzed me. What was going on? Immediately, I transferred to his line.
"Where are you?" he asked.
"Dusting off some debris," I said, and smiled toward Chris.
"Get in here. Get in here fast," he barked.
"What's going on, Sam? This about the quake?"
"Uh-uh," he replied. "Worse. Nicholas Jenks has escaped."
Chapter 111. As he sat shackled to the seat of the police van on the way back from Napa, Nicholas Jenks watched the impassive eyes of the patrolman across from him. He plotted, schemed. He wondered how much it would take to buy his freedom. 1 million? 2 million? After all, what did the fool take home, 40 grand a year? He figured the steely-eyed officer was someone above reproach, whose commitment to his duty was unquestioned. If he were writing it, that's who he would have put in the car with him. 5 million, then, he smirked. If he were writing it. That notion possessed a cold, punishing irony for him. He had written it. Jenks shifted in his restraints. Wrists cuffed, torso strapped to the seat. Only minutes earlier he had stood in the red-brick courthouse in Santa Rosa, while the prosecutor, in her little Liz Claiborne suit, pointed her finger at him. Over and over she accused him of things only a mind as cultivated as his would think up and do. All he could do was stare coldly while she accused him of being this monster. Sometime he'd like to lock her in the law library and show her what he was really capable of. Jenks caught a glimpse of the sky and the sun-browned hills through the narrow window in the rear door and tried to get a fix on their bearings. Novato, just hitting Marin. He pressed his face to the steel restraining wall. He had to get out. If he were writing it, there would always be a way out. He looked at the guard. "So, what was the story, Joe Friday? What happened next?"
"You married?"
he asked. The policeman stared through him at first, then he nodded.
"Kids?"
"2. He nodded again, even breaking a slight smile. No matter how hard they tried to resist, they were always fascinated to talk with the monster. The guy who killed the honeymooners. They could tell their wives and friends, justify the miserable 600 a week they brought home. He was a celebrity.
"Wife work?" Jenks probed.
The cop nodded. "Teacher. Business ed. 8th grade.
Business ed, huh? Maybe he would understand a business proposition. "My wife used to work," Jenks grunted back. "My first wife, in retail. My current wife worked, too, in television. Of course, now she only works out."
The remark produced a snicker. The tight-assed bastard was loosening up. Jenks saw a landmark he recognized. 20 minutes from the Golden Gate Bridge. There wasn't much time left. He glanced out the window at the patrol car following them. There was another in front. A bitter resignation took hold. There was no way out. No elegant escape. That was in his books. This was life. He was screwed. Then, out of nowhere, the police van lurched violently. Jenks was hurled forward in his seat, toward the guard across from him. For a second, he wondered what was going on. Then the van lurched again. He heard a chilling, rumbling sound outside.
"It's a fucking quake!"
Jenks could see the lead police car swerve to avoid the charge of another car. Then it skidded off the road. One of the cops yelled, "Shit!" but the van continued on. Jenks spun around in panic, trying to hold on to anything that was fixed in the compartment. The van was bucking and jolting. The police car following them jumped over a sudden hump in the highway, and to his total amazement, flipped. The driver of Jenks's van looked behind him in shock. Then, suddenly, the other cop in front screamed for the driver to stop. An 18-wheeler was breached in their way. They were headed right toward it. The van swerved, and when it did, the road buckled again. Then they were out of control, flying.
"I am going to die here," Nicholas Jenks thought, "die here, without anyone ever knowing the whole truth."
The van crashed into the stanchions of a Conoco station. It screeched to a stop, spinning twice on its side. The officer across from him was hurled against the metal wall. He was writhing and moaning as he looked at Jenks.
"Don't move," the officer panted.
How the hell could he? He was still shackled to the seat. Then came this horrid wrenching sound, and they both looked up. The towering steel light above the station toppled like a redwood and crashed down on them. It smashed through the door of the van, striking the officer in back, probably killing him on impact. Jenks was sure he would be killed. All the smoke, the screams, the twisting of metal. But he wasn't. He was clear. The streetlight had torn a hole in the side of the car, ripped his restraints right out of the seat. He was able to kick himself free, even with shackled hands and feet, and push himself through the gaping hole. People were running in the street, screaming in panic. Motorists pulled off the road, some dazed, others jumping out of their vehicles to help.
This was it!
He knew if he didn't run, he would replay this moment for the rest of his life. Nicholas Jenks crawled out of the van, dazed and disoriented. He spotted no cops, only frightened passers-by streaking past. He limped out and joined the chaotic street scene.
"I'm free!" Jenks exulted.
"And I know who's setting me up. The cops won't get it in a million years." Chapter 112. It took about 3 minutes for Chris and me to throw on clothes and head back to the hall. In the rush, I never told him my news. By disaster standards, the quake was nothing much, unless you had spent the past 5 weeks tracking down the country's most notorious killer. Most of the damage ended up confined to shattered storefronts and traffic accidents north of the city, but as we pushed our way through the clamoring throng of press in the hall's lobby, the quake's biggest news crackled with the fierceness of a live wire. The bride and groom killer was free. Nicholas Jenks had managed to flee after the police van taking him back to jail had flipped over outside Novato, the result of a chain of automobile accidents caused by the tremor. The policeman guarding him had been fatally injured. Two more in the front seat of the overturned van were hospitalized. A huge command center was set up down the hall from homicide. Rolf himself took charge. The place was crawling with brass from downtown and, of course, the press. An APB was released, Jenks's description and photo distributed to cops on both sides of the bridge. All city exits and highway tolls were being monitored. Traffic slowed to a crawl. Airports, hotels, and car rental ports were put on alert. Since we had tracked Nicholas Jenks down originally, Rolly and I found ourselves at the center of the search. We placed an immediate surveillance on his residence. Cops spread out all over the Seacliff area from the Presidio to Land's End. In searches like this, the first 6 hours were critical. The key was to contain Jenks in the grid where he had bolted, not let him contact anyone who could help him. He had no resources, no funds, no one to take him in. Jenks couldn't stay on the loose, unless he was a lot craftier than I thought he was. The escape left me stunned. The man I had hunted down was free, but I was also left conflicted. Were we hunting the right man? Everyone had a theory about where he might head. The wine country, east into Nevada. I had my own theory. I didn't think he'd head back to the house. He was too smart, and there was nothing to be gained there. I asked Roth if I could borrow Jacoby and Paul Chin to play out a hunch. I took Jacoby aside. "I need you to do me a big favor, Warren." I asked him to do surveillance outside Joanna Wade's apartment on Russian Hill. I asked Chin to do the same outside the house of Jenks's former agent, Greg Marks. If Jenks really believed he was being set up, those were two places he might go. Jacoby gave me a look as if I was sending him out on another champagne lead. The entire corps of inspectors was following up leads.
What the hell, Lindsay? Why?
I needed him to trust me. Because it struck me as funny, too, I said, begging his support. Why Jenks would leave that damn tuxedo jacket behind. I think he might go after Joanna. Trust me on it. With Warren and Paul Chin in place, there was nothing I could do.